This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Behold the Dreamers by Imbolo Mbwe. Read for you by Prentice Oniyemi. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land with streams and pools of water, with springs flowing in the valleys and hills, a land with wheat and barley, vines and fig trees, pomegranates, olive oil, and honey, a land where bread will not be scarce and you will lack nothing, a land where the rocks are iron and you can dig copper out of the hills. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 7 through 9. Chapter 1. He'd never been asked to wear a suit to a job interview, never been told to bring along a copy of his resume. He hadn't even owned a resume until the previous week, when he'd gone to the library on 34th and Madison, and a volunteer career counselor had written one for him, detailed his work history to suggest he was a man of grand accomplishments. Farmer, responsible for tilling land and growing healthy crops. Street cleaner, responsible for making sure the town of Limbe looked beautiful and pristine. Dishwasher in Manhattan restaurant, in charge of ensuring patrons ate from clean and germ-free plates. Livery cab driver in the Bronx, responsible for taking passengers safely from place to place. He'd never had to worry about whether his experience would be appropriate, whether his English would be perfect, whether he would succeed in coming across as intelligent enough. But today, dressed in the green double-breasted pinstripe suit he'd worn the day he entered America, his ability to impress a man he'd never met was all he could think about. Try as he might, he could do nothing but think about the questions he might be asked, the answers he would need to give, the way he would have to walk and talk and sit, the times he would need to speak or listen and nod, the things he would have to say or not say, the response he would need to give if asked about his legal status in the country. His throat went dry. His palms moistened. Unable to reach for his handkerchief in the packed downtown subway, he wiped both palms on his pants.
"Good morning, please,"
he said to the security guard in the lobby when he arrived at Lehman Brothers.
"My name is Jende Chonga. I am here for Mr. Edwards, Mr. Clark Edwards."
The guard, goateed and freckled, asked for his ID, which he quickly pulled out of his brown bifold wallet. The man took it, examined it front and back, looked up at his face, looked down at his suit, smiled, and asked if he was trying to become a stockbroker or something. Jende shook his head.
"No,"
he replied without smiling back.
"A chauffeur."
"Right on," the guard said as he handed him a visitor pass.
"Good luck with that."
This time, Jende smiled.
"Thank you, my brother," he said. "I really need all that good luck today."
Alone in the elevator to the 28th floor, he inspected his fingernails. No dirt, thankfully. He adjusted his clip-on tie using the security mirror above his head, re-examined his teeth, and found no visible remnants of the fried ripe plantains and beans he'd eaten for breakfast. He cleared his throat and wiped off whatever saliva had crusted on the sides of his lips. When the doors opened, he straightened his shoulders and introduced himself to the receptionist, who, after responding with a nod and a display of extraordinarily white teeth, made a phone call and asked him to follow her. They walked through an open space where young men in blue shirts sat in cubicles with multiple screens, down a corridor, past another open space of cluttered cubicles and into a sunny office with a four-paneled glass window running from wall to wall and floor to ceiling. The thousand autumn-drenched trees and proud towers of Manhattan standing outside, For a second, his mouth fell open at the view outside, the likes of which he'd never seen, and the exquisiteness inside. There was a lounging section, black leather sofa, two black leather chairs, glass coffee table, to his right, an executive desk, oval, cherry, black leather reclining chair for the executive, two green leather armchairs for visitors, in the center, and a wall unit, cherry, glass doors, white folders in neat rows, to his left, in front of which Clark Edwards, in a dark suit, was standing and feeding sheets of paper into a pull-out shredder.
"Please, sir. Good morning,"
Jende said, turning toward him and half-bowing.
"Have a seat,"
Clark said, without lifting his eyes from the shredder. Jende hurried to the armchair on the left. He pulled a resume from his folder and placed it in front of Clark's seat, careful not to disturb the layers of white papers and Wall Street journals strewn across the desk in a jumble. One of the journal pages, peeking from beneath sheets of numbers and graphs, had the headline, "White's Great Hope? Barack Obama and the Dream of a Colorblind America." Jende leaned forward to read the story, fascinated as he was by the young ambitious senator, but immediately sat upright when he remembered where he was, why he was there, what was about to happen.
"Do you have any outstanding tickets you need to resolve?" Clark asked as he sat down.
"No, sir," Jende replied.
"And you haven't been in any serious accidents, right?"
"No, Mr. Edwards."
Clark picked up the resume from his desk, wrinkled and moist, like the man whose history it held. His eyes remained on it for several seconds while Jende darted back and forth, from the Central Park treetops far beyond the window, to the office walls lined with abstract paintings and portraits of white men wearing bow ties. He could feel beads of sweat rising out of his forehead.
"Well, Jende,"
Clark said, putting the resume down and leaning back in his chair.
"Tell me about yourself."
Jende perked up. This was the question he and his wife, Nenni, had discussed the previous night. The one they'd read about when they Googled, the one question they ask at every job interview. They had spent an hour hunched over the cranky desktop, searching for the best answer, reading much too similar pieces of advice on the first 10 sites Google delivered, before deciding it would be best if Jende spoke of his strong character and dependability, and of how he had everything a busy executive like Mr. Edwards needed in a chauffeur. Nenni had suggested he also highlight his wonderful sense of humor, perhaps with a joke. After all, she had said, which Wall Street executive, after spending hours racking his brain on how to make more money, wouldn't appreciate entering his car to find his chauffeur ready with a good joke? Jende had agreed and prepared an answer, a brief monologue which concluded with a joke about a cow at a supermarket. That should work very well, Nenni had said. And he had believed so, too. But when he began to speak, he forgot his prepared answer.
"Okay, sir," he said instead. "I live in Harlem with my wife and with my 6-year-old son. And I am from Cameroon in Central Africa, or West Africa. It depends on who you ask, sir. I am from a little town on the Atlantic Ocean called Limbe."
"I see.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards,"
he said, his voice quivering, unsure of what he was thankful for.
"And what kind of papers do you have in this country?"
"I have papers, sir,"
he blurted out, leaning forward and nodding repeatedly, goosebumps shooting up all over his body like black balls out of a cannon.
"I said, what kind of papers?"
"Oh, I am sorry, sir. I have EAD. EAD, sir. That is what I have right now."
"What's that supposed—"
The BlackBerry on the desk buzzed. Clark quickly picked it up.
"What does that mean?"
he asked, looking down at the phone.
"It means employment authorization document, sir,"
Jende replied, shifting in his seat. Clark neither responded nor gestured. He kept his head down, his eyes on the smartphone, his soft-looking fingers jumping all over the keypad, lithely and speedily, up, left, right, down.
"It is a work permit, sir.
Jende added. He looked at Clark's fingers, then his forehead, and his fingers again, uncertain of how else to obey the rules of eye contact when eyes were not available for contact.
It means I am allowed to work, sir, until I get my green card.
Clark half nodded and continued typing. Jende looked out the window, hoping he wasn't sweating too profusely.
And how long will it take for you to get this green card?
Clark asked as he put down the BlackBerry.
I just really don't know, sir. Immigration is slow, sir. Very funny how they work.
But you're in the country legally for the long term, correct?
Oh, yes, sir,
Jende said. He nodded repeatedly again, a pained smile on his face, his eyes unblinking.
I am very legal, sir. I just am still waiting for my green card.
For a long second, Clark stared at Jende, his vacant green eyes giving no clue to his thoughts. Hot sweat was flowing down Jende's back, soaking the white shirt Nani had bought for him from a street vendor on 125th Street. The desk phone rang.
Very well, then, Clark said, picking up the phone. As long as you're legal.
Jende Jonga exhaled. The terror that had gripped his chest when Clark Edwards mentioned the word papers slowly loosened. He closed his eyes and offered thanks to a merciful being, grateful half the truth had been sufficient. What would he have said if Mr. Edwards had asked more questions? How would he have explained that his work permit and driver's license were valid only for as long as his asylum application was pending or approved, and that if his application were to be denied, all his documents would become invalid, and there would be no green card? How could he have possibly explained his asylum application? Would there have been a way to convince Mr. Edwards that he was an honest man? A very honest man, actually? But one who was now telling a thousand tales to immigration just so he could one day become an American citizen and live in this great nation forever.
And you've been here for how long?
Clark asked, after putting down the receiver.
3 years, sir. I came in 2004. In the month,
he paused, startled by Clark's thunderous sneeze.
May God bless you, sir,
he said, as the executive placed his wrist under his nose and let loose another sneeze, louder than the first.
Ashiasa, he added. May God bless you again.
Clark leaned forward and picked up a bottle of water on the right side of his desk. Behind him, far beyond the spotless glass window, a red helicopter flew above the park, going from west to east under the cloudless morning sky. Jende returned his gaze to Clark and watched as he took a few sips from the bottle. He yearned for a sip of water, too, to erase the dryness in his throat, but dared not change the trajectory of the interview by asking for some. No, he couldn't dare. Certainly not right now. His throat could be the driest spot in the Kalahari, and it wouldn't matter right now. He was doing well. Okay, maybe not too well, but he wasn't doing too badly either.
All right, Clark said, putting down the bottle. Let me tell you what I want in a driver.
Jende swallowed and nodded.
I demand loyalty. I demand dependability. I demand punctuality, and I demand that you do as I say and ask no questions. Works for you?
Yes, sir. Of course, Mr. Edwards.
You're going to sign a confidentiality agreement that you'll never say anything about what you hear me say or see me do. Never. To anyone. Absolutely no one. Do you understand?
I understand you very clearly, sir.
Good. I'll treat you right, but you must treat me right first. I'll be your main priority, and when I don't need you, you'll take care of my family. I'm a busy man, so don't expect me to supervise you. You've come to me very highly recommended.
I give you my word, sir. I promise. My full word.
Very good, Jende, Clark said.
He smirked, nodded, and said again,
Very good.
Jende pulled his handkerchief from his pants pocket and dabbed his forehead. He took a deep breath and waited for Clark to scan his resume one more time.
"Do you have any questions for me?"
Clark asked, moving the resume to a pile of papers on the left side of his desk.
"No, Mr. Edwards. You have told me what I need to know very well, sir."
"I've got one more interview tomorrow morning. Then I'll make my decision. You'll hear from me maybe later tomorrow. My secretary will call you."
"Thank you so much, sir. You are very kind."
Clark stood up. Jende quickly pushed back his chair and stood up too. He straightened his tie, which over the course of the interview had become as tilted as a willowy tree in a wild storm.
"By the way," Clark said, looking at the tie, "if you hope to further your career, you'll get a better suit, black, blue, or gray, and a real tie."
"Not a problem at all, sir," Jende replied. "I can find a new suit, sir. I surely can."
He nodded and smiled awkwardly, revealing his crowded teeth and promptly shutting his mouth. Clark, without smiling back, offered a hand, which Jende took with both of his and shook with great care. His head bowed.
"Thank you so much in advance, sir," he wanted to say again. "I will be the best chauffeur ever if you give me this job," he almost said. He didn't say it.
He had to keep his desperation from bursting through the thin layer of dignity it had been wrapped in throughout the interview. Clark smiled and patted him on the arm. Chapter 2.
1.5 years today,
Nenny said to Fatou as they walked through Chinatown looking for make-believe Gucci and Versace bags.
"That's how long it's been since I came to America."
1.5 years?
Fatou said, shaking her head and rolling her eyes.
"You count half years, too. And you say it. No shame."
She laughed.
"Let me tell you something. When you're in America, 24, and you still poor, you're not gonna count no more. You're not gonna even say no more. No. You're gonna shame to say anything, I tell you."
Nenny chuckled as she picked up a Gucci tote, so determined to pass as real it glimmered.
"You're ashamed to tell people you have been here for 24 years? No, I no shame. Why ashamed? I tell people I just come here. They hear me talk. They say, she don't know English. She must have just come from Africa."
The Chinese store owner rushed toward them. "Take the bag for $60, he said to Nenny.
"Why?" Nenny asked, contorting her face. "I give you 20.
The man shook his head. Nenny and Fatou started walking away.
40, 40,
the man shouted at them as they pushed through a throng of European tourists.
"Okay, come take for 30, he shouted.
They went back and bought it for 25.
"Now you look like Angelina Jolie,"
Fatou said as Nenny walked with the bag on her arm, her curly weave flowing behind her.
"Really?"
Nenny said, tossing her hair.
"What you mean, really? You wanna look like Angelina Jolie, no?"
Nenny threw her head back and giggled. How she loved New York City. She still couldn't believe she was here, couldn't believe she was walking around shopping for Gucci, no longer a jobless, unwed mother, sitting in her father's house in Limbe, sunrise to sunset, dry season to rainy season, waiting for Jende to rescue her. It didn't seem like 18 months already, perhaps because she still remembered much about the day she and Leomi arrived at JFK. She still remembered how Jende had stood at the terminal waiting for them, dressed in a red shirt and blue clip-on tie, a bouquet of yellow hydrangeas in his hands. She still remembered how they had embraced and held each other for almost a minute in silence, their eyes tightly shut to banish the agony of the past 2 years in which he had worked 3 jobs to save the money needed for her student visa, Leomi's visitor visa, and their airline tickets. She remembered how Leomi had joined in their embrace, grabbing both of their legs before Jende had paused from holding her to pick him up. She remembered how the apartment, which Jende had recently found after almost 2 years of sharing a two-bedroom basement apartment with 6 Puerto Rican men in the Bronx, was that night filled with Jende's laughter and her voice delighting him with stories from back home, alongside Leomi's squeals as father and son roughhoused and tickled each other on the carpet. She remembered how they had moved Leomi from their bed to the cot in the middle of the night so they could lie side by side, do all the things they had promised to do to each other in emails and phone calls and text messages. And she still clearly remembered lying in bed next to Jende after they were done, listening to the sounds of America outside the window, the chatter and laughter of African-American men and women on the streets of Harlem, and telling herself, I am in America. I am truly in America. She could never forget that day. Or the day 2 weeks after their arrival, when they were married at City Hall with Leomi as their ring-bearer and Jende's cousin, Winston, as their witness. On that day in May 2006, she finally became a respectable woman, a woman declared worthy of love and protection. Limbe was now some faraway town, a place she had loved less with every new day Jende was not there. Without him to go for a walk on the beach with, go dancing with, or sit with at a drinking spot and enjoy a cold Malta Guinness on a hot Sunday afternoon, the town was no longer her beloved hometown, but a desolate place she couldn't wait to get out of. In every phone call during the time they were apart, she had reminded him of this, of her inability to stop daydreaming about the day she would leave Limbe and be with him in America. I dream too, bebe, he always said to her. Day and night, I dream all kinds of dreams. On the day she and Leomi got their visas, she had gone to bed with their passports under her pillow. On the night they left Cameroon, she felt nothing. As the bus her father had rented to drive them, and the 24 family and friends who came along to escort them, pulled out from in front of their house to begin the 2-hour trip to Douala International Airport, she had smiled and waved at the neighbors and extended family members who had gathered on the front lawn to enviously bid them farewell. She had taken a panoramic mental photograph of them, knowing she wouldn't be missing them for too long, wishing them the same happiness she knew she was going to find in America. A year and a half later now, and New York City was her home, a place with all the pleasures she desired. She woke up next to the man she loved and turned her face to see their child. For the first time in her life, she had a job as a home health aide through an agency that paid her in cash since she had no working papers. She was a matriculated student for the first time in 16 years, studying chemistry at Borough of Manhattan Community College, never worrying about her tuition because she knew Jende would always pay the $3,000 a semester fee without grumbling. Unlike her father, who unceasingly complained about his financial headaches and delivered a lecture about CFA francs not growing on mango trees whenever one of his 8 children asked for money for school fees or new uniforms. For the first time in much too long, she didn't wake up in the morning with no plans except to clean the house, go to the market, cook for her parents and siblings, take care of Leomi, meet with her friends and listen to them bash their mothers-in-law, go to bed, and look forward to more of the same the next day, because her life was going neither forward nor backward. And for the very first time in her life, she had a dream besides marriage and motherhood, to become a pharmacist, like the ones everyone respected in Limbe, because they handed out health and happiness in pill bottles. To achieve this dream, she had to do well in school, and she was doing just that, maintaining a B-plus average. 3 days a week she went to school, and after classes walked the school's hallways with her bulky algebra, chemistry, biology, and philosophy textbooks, glowing because she was growing into a learned woman. As often as she could, she sat in the library to do her homework, or went to office hours to hound professors for advice on what she needed to do to get better grades so she could get into a great pharmacy school. She was going to make herself proud, make Jende proud of his wife, make Leomi proud of his mother. She'd waited too long to become something, and now At 33, she finally had, or was close enough to having, everything she'd ever wanted in life. Chapter 3. He was on White Plains Road when the call came in. 4 minutes later, he closed his flip phone and laughed. He pounded the steering wheel and laughed even louder, jubilant, bemused, incredulous. If he had been driving in Newtown, Limbe, he would have gotten out of the car and hugged someone on the street, telling them, "Boo! You won't even believe the news I just got." In Newtown, he would have known at least one person on the street with whom to share his good news. But here, on these streets of old brick houses and faded lawns in the Bronx, he knew no one he could run to and repeat what Clark's secretary had just told him. There was a young black man walking with headphones on, banging his head to some kind of good music. 3 teenage Asian girls covering their mouths and giggling, none of them with a school bag. A woman rushing somewhere, pushing a fat baby in a pink umbrella stroller. There was an African man, too, but judging from his dark, angular face and flowing grand boubou, he had to be Senegalese or Burkinabe, or from one of the other French-speaking West African countries. Jende could not run out to him just because they were both West Africans. He needed to rejoice with someone who knew his name and his story.
"Oh, Papa God, Jens,"
Nenny said when he called her with the news.
"I cannot believe it. Can you?"
He smiled and shook his head, knowing her question needed no response. She was merely as happy as he was. From the sounds coming alongside her voice, he could tell she was dancing, jumping, skipping around the apartment like a child bearing a handful of sweets.
"Did she say exactly how much they are going to pay you?"
$35,000.
"Mamma mia, Papa Godot, I'm dancing right now, gents. I'm doing gymnastics, sir."
She wanted to stay on the phone, rejoice together for at least 10 more minutes, but she had to leave for her chemistry class. He kept on smiling after she hung up, amused by her joy, which flowed mightier than Victoria Falls. He called his cousin Winston next.
"Congrats, my man," Winston said. "Wonders shall never end."
"I'm telling you," Jende said.
"So, you, this bush boy from Newtown, Limbe, you're going to drive a Wall Street exec, eh? You'll now be driving a shiny Lexus instead of that Shakara Hyundai."
Jende laughed.
"I don't know how to thank you," he said. "I just can't even begin to..."
His passenger in the back seat said something.
"Hold on, Bo," he said to Winston.
He turned around and realized the woman was on her cell phone too, speaking in a language he'd never heard, while he was speaking in pidgin English, interspersed with French and Bakweri, neither of them understanding the other, both of them inadvertently creating a quasi-babble in a New York City livery cab.
"What did you tell these people about me?"
he asked Winston.
"The man said I came to him highly recommended."
"Nothing," Winston replied. "I only told Frank you drive a limo sometimes, and that you used to chauffeur a family in New Jersey."
"What?"
"I lie, I die," Winston said, snickering. "You think a black man gets a good job in this country by sitting in front of white people and telling the truth? Please, don't make me laugh. I just didn't want to tell you beforehand and get you even more nervous."
"Boo, you serious? But I didn't have any of that on my resume. How come?"
"Ah, you and your shocks. The man's a busy man. I knew he wasn't going to sit there asking you every kind of question. Frank's his best friend."
"What?
You're not happy I told him?"
"Happy?"
Jende said in a near scream, shaking his head and throwing it back.
"I want to jump out of this car right now and come kiss your feet."
"No, thank you," Winston said. "I'm interviewing some guys to do that for me."
"Yes, you are,"
Jende said, guffawing.
"I won't get jealous, because Nenny will kill me."
Winston laughed so hard he snorted.
"The one last night, Bo! Let me tell you."
"But what are we going to do about this background check thing?" Jende asked. "The secretary says I have to give this thing, this Reverences.
Don't worry about that. We'll fill out the forms together when I come over. I have some people for the references.
I owe you, Bo. In short, I don't even know how I'll ever thank you.
Just stop this thank you business right now, eh?
Winston said.
You're my brother. If I don't do it for you, who will I do it for? Tell Nenny to cook for me her special pepper soup recipe. The one with cow feet and chicken gizzards. That's all I want. I'm coming over tomorrow evening.
You don't even have to ask. The food will be waiting for you, plus frozen palm wine and fresh soya.
Winston congratulated him again and said he had to get back to a brief he was working on. Jende continued driving around the Bronx, picking up passengers, dropping them off, listening to Light FM, unable to discard the grin on his face. His cell phone beeps to announce a new text message. "You just get your papers now," Nenny wrote, "and we'll be all set." Isn't that the truth, he thought. First a good job, then papers. How good would that feel? He sighed. 3 years. That's how long he'd been fighting for papers in America. He'd been in the country for only 4 weeks when Winston took him to meet with an immigration lawyer. They needed to find a way for him to stay in the country permanently after his visitor visa expired. That had been their plan all along, though it wasn't what Jende had said when he went to the American embassy in Yaoundé to apply for the visa.
"How long do you plan on staying in New York City?" the consulate had asked him. "Only 3 months, sir," he had replied. "Just 3 months, and I promise I will return."
And he had submitted evidence to back his claim. His work supervisor's letter describing him as a diligent employee who loved his job so much he would never abandon it to go roam around aimlessly in America. His son's birth certificate to show he would never remain in America and desert his child. The title on a piece of land his father had given him to show he intended to return and build on the land. A letter from the town planning office, which he'd paid a distant uncle who worked in the office to get for him, stating that he had applied for a permit to build a house. A letter from a friend who swore under oath that Jende wasn't going to remain in America because they were going to open a drinking spot together when he returned. The consular officer had been convinced. The next day, Jende had walked out of the consular office with his visa. Yes, he was going to America. He, Jende Dikaki Jonga, son of Ikola Jonga, grandson of Dikaki Manyakama Jonga, was going to America. He skipped out of the embassy and onto the dusty streets of Yaoundé, pumping his fist and grinning so wide an Ewondo woman carrying a basket of plantains on her head stopped mid-stride to stare at him.
"Quel est son problème?"
he heard her say to a friend. He laughed. He didn't have a problem. He was leaving Cameroon in a month. Leaving to certainly not return after 3 months. Who traveled to America only to return to a future of nothingness in Cameroon after a mere 3 months? Not young men like him. Not people facing a future of poverty and despondency in their own country. No, people like him did not visit America. They got there and stayed there until they could return home as conquerors. As green card or American passport bearing conquerors with pockets full of dollars and photos of a happy life. Which was why on the day he boarded an Air France flight from Douala to Newark with a connection in Paris, he was certain he wouldn't see Cameroon again until he had claimed his share of the milk, honey, and liberty flowing in the paradise for strivers called America.
"Asylum is the best way to get papier and remain in the country," Winston told him after he had gotten over his jet lag and spent half a day walking around Times Square in astonishment. "Either that, or you marry an old white woman in Mississippi with no teeth."
"Please, God forbid bad things," he had replied. "Better you give me a bottle of kerosene to drink and die right now."
Asylum was the only way for him to go, he decided. Winston agreed. It could take years, he said, but it would be worthwhile. Winston hired a lawyer for him, a fast-talking Nigerian in Flatbush, Brooklyn, named Bubaka, who was as short as his speech was fast. Boubacar, Winston had been told, was not only a great immigration lawyer with hundreds of African clients all over the country, but also an expert in the art of giving clients the best stories of persecution to gain asylum.
"How do you think all these people who gain asylum do it?"
he asked the cousins when they met with him for a free consultation.
"You think they're all really running away from something? Police! Let me tell you something. I just won asylum only last month for the daughter of the prime minister of some country in East Africa."
"Really?" Winston asked.
"Yes, really,"
Boubacar replied, snarling.
"What do you mean, really?"
"I'm just surprised. What country?"
"I'd rather not mention, okay? It doesn't really matter. My point is that this girl's father is a prime minister, eh? She has three people wiping her ass after she shits, and three more people dragging the boogers out of her nose. And here she is, saying she's afraid for her life back home."
He scoffed.
"We all do what we gotta do to become American, Abby."
Jende nodded. Winston shrugged. A friend of his in Atlanta was the one who had referred him to Boubacar and spoken highly of the man. The friend had no doubt that Boubacar was the reason he was still in America, why he now had a green card and was only 2 years away from being eligible to apply for citizenship. Still, from Winston's downturned lips, Jende could tell his cousin was having a hard time believing that the small man with extra long hair flying out of his perpetually flared nostrils was an expert in anything, never mind the complex legal field of asylum-based immigration. The diploma on his wall said he'd gone to some law school in Nebraska, but to Winston, his mannerisms must have said he'd gotten his real education via online immigration forums, the sites where many with aspirations for American passports gathered to find ways to triumph over the American immigration system.
"My brother," Boubacar said to Jende,
looking at him across the bare desk in his ultra-clean and perfectly organized office.
"Why don't we start by you telling me more about you, so I can see how I can help you?"
Jende sat up in his chair, clasped his hands on his lap, and began telling his story. He spoke of his father, the farmer, his mother, the trader and pig breeder, his four brothers, and their two-bedroom Karabot house in Newtown, Limbe. He spoke of attending primary school at CBC Main School, and the interruption of his secondary education at National Comprehensive Secondary School after he impregnated Neni.
"Eh, you stop because you pregnant a girl,"
Boubacar said, jotting down something.
"Yes," Jende replied. "Her father put me in prison because of it."
"Boom, that's it,"
Boubacar said as he lifted his head from his writing pad, his eyes glowing with excitement.
"What is it?" Winston asked.
"His asylum. The story will tell immigration."
Winston and Jende looked at each other. Jende was thinking Boubacar must know what he was talking about. Winston looked like he was thinking Boubacar must know nothing about what he was talking about.
"What are you talking about?" Winston asked. "The imprisonment happened in 1990, 14 years ago. How are you going to convince a judge that my cousin's afraid of persecution back in Cameroon because he impregnated a girl and got sent to prison a long time ago? Mind you, in our country, and maybe even in your country, it's perfectly within the law for a father to have a young man arrested for complicating his daughter's future."
Boubacar looked at Winston with scorn, his lip curled down on one side.
"Mr. Winston," he said
after a long pause, during which he wrote something down and deliberately placed his pen on his writing pad.
"Yes?"
"I understand we are both lawyers, and you are Wall Street smart. Is that no so?"
Winston did not respond.
"Let me guarantee you something, my friend," Boubacar continued. "You wouldn't know the first thing to do if you are put before an immigration judge and asked to fight for the likes of your cousin, okay? So, why don't you allow me to do what I know? And if I ever need a lawyer to help me find a way to hide taxes from the government, I'll let you do what you know."
"My job is not to help people find ways to hide taxes,"
Winston replied, keeping his voice low, even though Jende could tell from his unblinking eyes that he yearned to reach across the table and punch out all the teeth from Boubacar's mouth.
"You don't do that, eh?" Boubacar asked with mock interest. "So, tell me, what is it that you do at Wall Street?"
Winston scoffed. Jende said nothing, equally as angered as his cousin. Perhaps afraid he'd gone too far, Boubacar tried to rein in his comments and appease the cousins.
"My brothers, make we no vex," he said,
switching to a blend of Cameroonian and Nigerian pidgin English.
"Now no be time for vex. We get work for do, abi. Now na time for go before. No be so."
"Na so," Winston replied.
"Let's just stick to the matter at hand."
Jende sighed and waited for the conversation to return to his asylum application.
"But just so you know," Winston added, "my job as a corporate lawyer does not involve any lying or manipulation."
"Of course," Boubacar replied. "I'm sorry, my brother. I must have mistaken it with another kind of law."
The two men laughed.
"What happened to the young lady you impregnated?"
Boubacar said, turning to Jende. "She is back in Limbe."
"And the child you had with her?"
"She died."
"I'm so sorry, oh my brother. So sorry."
Jende averted his gaze. He needed no sympathies. He certainly did not need condolences coming 14 years later.
"You went to prison before or after she died?"
"Before she was born, when my girl's parents found out I was the one who pregnant her."
"That's how it normally works," Winston said. "Parents call the police, boyfriend gets arrested."
Boubacar nodded, double underlining a word on his writing pad. "I was in prison for 4 months. I came out, the baby was 1 month old. 3 months later, she died of yellow fever."
"Sorry, my brother," Boubacar said again. "Truly sorry."
Jende took a sip from a glass of water on the table and cleared his throat.
"But I have another child in Cameroon," he said. "I have a 3-year-old son."
"With the same woman that you had the daughter with?"
"Yes. She is the mother of my son. She is still my girlfriend. We would be married now and be a family with our son if only our father would let me marry her."
"And what's his reason for disapproving of the marriage?"
"He says he needs time to think about it. But I know it's because I'm a poor man."
"It's a class thing," Winston said.
"Jende's from a poor family. This young lady's family has a bit more money."
"Or maybe it's because this young lady's father hasn't gotten over what happened to his daughter,"
Boubacar said.
"I mean, as a father, to see your young daughter get pregnant, drop out of school, and then lose the child is all very hard, Abi. I don't think I'll ever like the person who did this to my daughter, whether he is from a rich family or a poor family."
Neither cousin responded.
"But it doesn't really matter what his reason is," Boubacar continued. "I think the story is our best chance for your asylum. We claim persecution based on belonging to a particular social group. We weave a story about how you're afraid of going back home because you're afraid your girlfriend's family wants to kill you so you two don't get married."
"That sounds like something that would happen in India," Winston said. "No one does anything like that in Cameroon."
"Are you trying to say Cameroon is better than India?"
Boubacar retorted.
"I'm trying to say Cameroon is not like India."
"Leave that up to me, my brother,"
Winston sighed. "When can we send the application?" Jende asked.
"As soon as you provide me with all the evidence."
"Evidence? Like what?"
"Like what? Like your prison record. Birth certificates of your children, both of them. Death certificate of the little girl. Letters. Lots of letters from people who say that they've heard this man say he's going to kill you if he ever sees you again. People who've heard his brothers, his cousins, anyone in their family talk about destroying you. Pictures, too. In fact,
anything and everything about you and this girl and her father. Can you get it for me?
I'll try, Jende said hesitantly. But what if I cannot get enough evidence?
Boubacar looked at him with a dash of amusement and shook his head.
Ah, my brother,
he said, putting down his pen and leaning forward.
Do I have to spell it out for you? You got to use your common sense and produce for me something I can show these people. Eh? It's like that man Jerry Maguire says. Show me the money. These people at USCIS are going to say, show me the evidence. Show me the evidence, you get me?
He laughed at his own joke. Winston puffed. Jende did not react. He never heard of a man named Jerry Maguire.
We got to show a lot of stuff to convince them, you understand me? One way or another, we produce a lot of evidence.
We'll see what we can do, Winston said.
Jende nodded in agreement. Although he knew getting the kind of letters Boubacar wanted would be difficult. Nani's father didn't like him. That he'd known for years. But the old man had never once threatened to kill him. No one in Limbe could attest to that. But filing for asylum was his best chance at staying in the country. So he had to do something. He would have to talk it out with Winston and see what could be done. Winston would have ideas on how to do it.
And you're confident this will work?
Winston asked.
I'll make a strong case, Boubacar said. Your cousin will get his papers, inshallah.
Chapter 4 She couldn't go to bed until he got home. She had to hear everything about his first day at work. When she had called him around noon to find out how his day was going, he had hurriedly said it was going good. He couldn't talk, but everything was good. So she'd had no choice but to wait. And now, at almost midnight, she could finally hear him at the door, panting after having climbed the 5 flights of stairs it took to get to their apartment.
So?
She asked, grinning as he sat down on the threadbare living room sofa.
I cannot complain. He said, smiling. It went well.
She went into the kitchen and got him a glass of cold water, helped him take off his jacket, and after he'd rested on the sofa with his head thrown back for about a minute, brought out his dinner and pulled out a chair so he could make himself comfortable at the dinette set. Then she began asking him questions. What exactly did he do for the family? Where did he drive them to? What did the Edwards' apartment look like? Was Mrs. Edwards a nice lady? Was their son well-behaved? Was he going to be working this late every day? He was tired, but she was persistent, scattering the questions all over him like confetti on a victorious warrior. She had to know how rich people lived, how they behaved, what they said. If they could hire someone to drive them around, then their lives must really be something, eh?
Come on, she said. Tell me.
So he told her everything he could in between mouthfuls of his dinner. The Edwards' apartment was big and beautiful, he said. Millions of dollars more beautiful than their sunless one-bedroom apartment. One could see the whole city through the window in their living room. His mouth had dropped open when he saw it.
Chai!
She said.
What would it be like to have a place like that? I'll jump and touch the sky every day.
The place looked like one of those rich people apartments you see on television, he went on. Everything was white or silver, very clean, very shiny. He'd spent only a few minutes there while waiting to take Mighty to school after he returned from dropping Mr. Edwards at work. Mrs. Edwards had asked him to come upstairs because 9-year-old Mighty wanted to be properly introduced before being chauffeured to school.
A very nice child. And a well-brought-up one, too, that Mighty, he said. That's good to hear, she said. A rich child who is well-brought-up.
She wanted to ask if Mighty was as well-brought-up as their Leomi, but she didn't. She thought it best to follow the advice her mother had given her years ago about abstaining from comparing her child to another woman's child.
They only have this one child,
she asked instead. He shook his head.
Mighty told me he has a big brother.
He lives uptown in another apartment they own and goes to Columbia University, the School of Law.
You're going to be driving him around too?
Maybe. I don't know.
If I have to drive him too, it's no problem.
But from the way Mighty was talking, it looks like the brother doesn't come to visit them often. And Mrs. Edwards is not happy about it. I didn't ask him any more questions.
She filled up his half-empty glass of water and allowed him to eat in silence for a few minutes before resuming her questions.
And Mrs. Edwards, she went on, what does she look like?
Good-looking, he replied. Just like a woman with a rich husband should look. Winston said she's one of those food people.
What food people?
The people who teach other people how to eat. So they can look one way or not look another way.
He picked up the can of Mountain Dew she'd set on the table, opened it, and took a long sip.
People in this country, always worrying about how to eat. They pay someone good money to tell them, eat this, don't eat that. If you don't know how to eat, what else can you know how to do in this world?
So, she must be slim and really good-looking.
He nodded distractedly, sweat pouring down his face from the extra pepper she'd tossed into the chicken and tomato sauce. Ignoring the sweat, he picked up a drumstick, ripped the meat off the bone with his front teeth, and sucked the juice inside the bone.
But what exactly does she look like?
She pressed on.
Ah, bebe, details, please.
He sighed and said he couldn't remember too much about what she looked like. The one thing he remembered, he said, was that when he first saw her, he thought she looked something like the wife in American Beauty, a movie they both loved and watched whenever they wanted to remind themselves that life in American suburbs could be very strange, and maybe it was best to live in peaceful American cities like New York City.
What's the real name of that woman again?
He asked with a full mouth, tomato sauce running down his fingers.
You're the one who knows these things.
Annette Bening?
Yes, yes. That's who she looks like.
With the same eyes and everything. She must be beautiful, eh?
He said he could not remember if Cindy Edwards had Annette Bening's eyes.
It's not like you can even know what her real eyes are like, she said. Some of them wear colored contacts. They can change their eyes whenever they feel like it. A woman like Mrs. Edwards, she was probably born into a rich family and started wearing colored contacts even as a child.
I don't know.
Rich father, rich mother, rich husband. I'm sure her whole life she's never known what it's like to worry about money.
Licking his lips, he picked up a piece of plantain from the plate, broke it with his fingers, dunked half of it into the tomato sauce bowl, and hurriedly pushed it into his mouth for processing. She watched him, amused at the speed with which he was devouring his food.
And then what happened after you dropped Mighty off at school?
She asked. He came back and picked up Mrs. Edwards, he said. Took her to her office and then to an appointment in Battery Park City and to another appointment in Soho before taking her home and picking up Mighty from school and driving him and his nanny to a building on the Upper West Side, where he got his piano lessons. He took Mighty and his nanny home after the lesson and then picked up Mr. Edwards from his office and drove him to a steakhouse on Long Island and back to the city around 10. He refilled the gas, parked the car in the garage, and took the crosstown bus from the east side to the west side. Then he caught the Uptown 3 subway home.
Way!
She exclaimed.
Isn't that a lot of work for one person in one day?
Sure, it might be, he told her. But for the kind of money he was being paid, wasn't it to be expected? She shouldn't forget, he said, that 2 weeks ago he was making only half of what Mr. Edwards was paying him, driving the livery cab 12 hours every day. She nodded in agreement and said,
We can only thank God.
He lifted his glass of water and took a sip.
I calculated your 35,000 salary plus my 10,000,
she said as she refilled his glass again.
After we pay your taxes and my school fees and rent and send money back home and everything else, we can still save like $300 or $400 a month.
$400 a month?
She nodded, smiling, amazed, too, at how so much can change in so little time.
We save like that, baby, she said. We try really hard, we can save $5,000 a year. 10 years, we could have enough money for down payment for a two-bedroom in Mount Vernon or Yonkers.
She moved her head closer to his.
Or even New Rochelle.
He shook his head. We are going to start paying more for rent one day. How long do you think before the government finds out Mr. Charles is qualifying for cheap housing even though he drives a Hummer? They find out we are paying him to live here. They kick us out. So? Someday, we are going to start paying more than $500 for rent, and $45,000 to live in Harlem will be nothing. She shrugged. Just like him to think of all the bad things that could happen.
Someday is not today, she countered. Before they find out, we would have saved some money. I'll be a pharmacist by then.
She smiled again, her eyes narrowing as if she were dreaming of that day.
We'll have our own apartment, 2 bedrooms. You'll make more money as a chauffeur. I'll make a good pharmacy salary. We won't live in this place full of cockroaches anymore.
He looked at her and smiled back. And she imagined he believed, too, that someday she would be a pharmacist. Hopefully 5 years, maybe 7 years, but still someday. She watched him take the last piece of plantain from the plate, use it to clean the tomato sauce bowl, and rush it, together with the last piece of chicken, into his mouth. Looking at him lovingly, she giggled as he finished up the Mountain Dew and burped.
You're a tanker,
she said to him, poking him in the ribs. He giggled too, wearily. Tired as he was, she could see how pleased he was. Nothing pleased him like a delicious dinner after a long day of work. Nothing pleased her like knowing she had pleased him. After a long pause, during which he leaned back in his seat and stared at the wall with a faint smile, he washed his hands in the bowl of water she had placed on the table and stood up.
Is Leumi in our bed or his bed?
He whispered from the hallway.
His bed, she said, smiling, knowing he would be happy for them to have the bed to celebrate on.
She picked up his dirty dishes and took them to the sink.
You any lo a la maniaca,
she sang softly, smiling still and swinging her hips as she cleaned the dishes.
You any lo a la maniaca, lo a langia, na weta miseli, e weni lo a la maniaca.
These days, she sang more than she had in her entire life. She sang when she ironed Jende's shirts and when she walked home after dropping Leumi off at school. She sang as she applied lipstick to head out with Jende and Leumi to an African party, a naming ceremony in Brooklyn, a traditional wedding in the Bronx, a death celebration in Yonkers for someone who had died in Africa and whom practically none of the guests knew. A party for one reason or another that she'd been invited to by a friend from school or work. Someone who knew the host and who'd assured her that it was okay to attend, since most African people didn't care about fancy white people ideas like attendance by invitation only. She sang walking to the subway and even sang in Pathmark, caring nothing about the looks she got from people who couldn't understand why someone could be so happy grocery shopping.
God na helele, God na waya ho, God na helele, God na waya ho. Nobody dey like a mo, nobody dey like a mo. E won one em, God na helele.
When she finished cleaning the dishes, she picked up Chende's jacket, the new black suit she had bought from TJ Maxx for $125, a third of their savings. She cleaned it with a lint brush, sprayed perfume on it, and laid it on the sofa for the next day. She looked at the jacket and smiled, glad she had bought it. She'd wanted to buy a cheaper one at the discount department store on 125th Street, but Fatou had dissuaded her.
Why you gonna buy cheap suit for him to drive big man, she had asked. You must buy from good store, like a TJ Maxx. Buy him fine suit for wear to drive fine car for rich man. And then one day, when he become rich man himself, you gonna buy from better store. You gonna buy his clothes. You gonna buy all your clothes from better store. Fine white people store, like a Target.